Love Sport Radio. On digital radio, online, mobile, and smart speaker. This is Upfront on Love Sport.
This is the James Gray Show podcast edition. Please do leave us a rating or a review wherever you get your podcasts. And remember, you can tune into the show every weekday from 1 p.m. until 3:30 p.m. on Love Sport Radio.
This is Love Sport.
Manchester City, of course, sealing a domestic treble. Pep Guardiola called it his fourth trophy of the season. No. I'm not having this. This is Jose Mourinho talk. The Community Shield or the Charity Shield, whatever it is, it's not a proper trophy. You only have to play one game to win it. Doesn't count. Super Cups don't count. You have to play an actual tournament to win a trophy, honestly. So let's just clear that up right from the start. I don't want to get too grumpy on a Monday lunchtime, but seriously, Pep, what are you doing? Nevertheless, we have to pay tribute to Manchester City because, yes, a domestic treble is impressive. And it's hard to do because it does involve a lot of games. Manchester City have played 61 games this season. That's only 3 short of the maximum. Had they got through to the Champions League final, it would have been 64. And then when you look at the body of work that Pep Guardiola has built up, he's had 10 seasons as a top-flight manager. He's only failed to win the league twice in those 10 seasons. You add to his 8 league titles, 5 national cups, 2 Champions Leagues as well. It's a pretty handy record, isn't it? Quite a good one, you might even say. He somehow hasn't captured the imagination. Matt Busby says it's not just about winning, it's also about glory. And those two things are slightly different. They're not completely the same. And what City have done is, yeah, they've been massively successful. But for some reason, not many hearts beat to the tune of Blue Moon. Not many spend their lives desperate for the news of the latest butterfly to have flapped its wings at the City Football Academy. Yes, if you go to Manchester, there's a lot of City fans. But outside of that, they don't have the same sort of fan base as the traditional top four, for example, the likes of Arsenal, Chelsea, Manchester United, Liverpool. They're one of the best teams in Europe, and yet they can't seem to compete on that level. And by the way, that's not down to a lack of coverage in the media. To the fan who confronted the press box at Wembley on Saturday after the FA Cup final, complaining that Mo Salah will still be on the back pages of the newspapers, I hope you went out and bought some of them and then saw them prove you wrong. If you're going to have the indecency to walk into someone's office and shout at them about what you think about their job, at least make sure you're a paying customer. I really hope he bought some newspapers on Sunday. I bet you he didn't. But if you take that week, and this is kind of what's wrong with football almost throughout it, success does funny things to people. It changes them. It addles the brain. It creates as many problems as it solves, frankly. And it's something that rarely breeds, you know, unity and peace for all mankind. Take that week in football, right? That week, capital T, capital W, when Spurs and Liverpool both produced those comebacks. Absolute games for the ages, on any level. As a journalist, I sat in the office on the Thursday, thinking, I just had that Sir Alex Ferguson clip going round in my head. Which I don't know if I can say it on air at this time of the day. Probably not. Football-y. I've avoided. I don't know. Maybe. And that was how I felt. I was kind of in awe, but it was a positive awe. I was smiling. And it seemed like I was in the minority. Because everyone around me was worrying about how awfully smug the Spurs or Liverpool fans were going to be when they finally won the Champions League. And how dreadful it was that these two clubs had progressed. Oh, it's going to be awful. Can you imagine? I don't want to live in this universe anymore. It's pathetic. How can you be a football fan and not appreciate what's going on here? How can you be a football fan and not appreciate brilliance that's surrounding you? And City fans were probably the same. They were probably hating every second of Spurs and Liverpool getting to the Champions League final. The Everton fans were singing City songs on the final day, for goodness sake. That's how desperate they were for someone not to win something. I've no doubt that man who stumbled into the press box on Saturday has had similar things to say about football. When's it our turn to be those teams getting to the Champions League final, he might have wondered. Well, probably when you win the Champions League, then people might appreciate you a bit more, but that's beside the point. The reason is you've made the domestic game startlingly facile. Taking all the unpredictability out of it. This is the problem with Man City. The absolute remorselessness of their winning streak. It's made their season a sort of even, steady, gradual progress towards the peak. There was no odd hiccup. No Hollywood writer worth their salt would have written Man City's story this year. It would have been dull. What's the point in a film if there's no jeopardy, no hardship, no suffering? You need a will-they-won't-they moment. Will he kiss the girl? Will they win the league? There almost was no question that they would. And yeah, if you squint a bit, you can probably find moments in the season where it all could have come crumbling down. But frankly, it was all a bit CBeebies. You know, it's great and well done to City. They're that much better, though. It's kind of got hard for people to get excited about them. Even on the pitch, they're relentlessly unrelenting. Their very style is a really quite neat microcosm of the club itself. Their high press, high intensity, very rarely comes unstuck. And even when they do win a trophy, they're still pushing. Guardiola was picking the ticker tape out of his snood while giving Sterling a lecture, you might say, about stealing a goal and getting on the end of a cross when maybe he shouldn't have done. I mean, that was even the day after City won the title, by the way. After they won it down at Brighton, Guardiola was in CFA at 8:30 in the morning for a breakfast meeting. The chef hadn't even turned up. There was no one there. But he was there for a breakfast meeting the day after they won the title. So if you're a City fan and you do feel that the world is against you, which it seems that City fans do, maybe consider the fact that it doesn't really matter. You've won 3 trophies. Celebrate it. Have some happiness. Enjoy that this is what you've been waiting for years. Being a football fan is mostly miserable. You mostly lose quite a lot. So when you win, enjoy it. Don't wait for everyone to come on bended knee and kiss the ring. Don't worry about what other people are saying about other clubs and how you're not getting enough adulation. Enjoy it. Take a day off and hope you don't get banned from the Champions League.
Love Sport.
As I mentioned earlier, it was a fiery weekend for Man City fans, loving the FA Cup victory but hating the reception of the media. And it wasn't only the fans. We also heard Pep Guardiola confront a journalist in a press conference over a question to do with payments. Now, the story is that there appears to be some evidence of some payments that were made to Roberto Mancini outside of his contract with the club. And Rob Harris, an excellent journalist who I hope is going to be joining us in a few minutes to talk about it. He's the global football and sports writer for AP. He asked a question that Pep Guardiola took some exception to.
Roberto Mancini was discovered to have had separate payments from Abu Dhabi while
okay,
he was
guys,
manager.
We're not
have you
go
ever
in.
Had separate payments from Abu
go into
Dhabi
that now.
While City manager?
Do you know the question as you ask him to me? Do you know the question asking me if I receive money for another situation right now today? Do you, honestly, do you think I deserve to make this kind of question and happen, Roberto? I don't know. Did they want the travel about the I've received money for another situations?
Okay, we're running an embargo now, please.
Oh,
on Mondays.
God.
Just down the front, please.
Are you
can
accusing
you
me?
What's
it? Are you accusing me to receive money for another situation?
No, I'd asked the question some time ago.
That's
but,
good.
I mean, it's only relevant because it came up again this week. That's why I said it's important.
Okay,
well.
Pass the mic, please, Rob.
There's Rob Harris there and Pep Guardiola going tete-a-tete in a press conference at the weekend. Plenty of reactions to this on Twitter as well. A lot of people annoyed with the fact that Rob Harris chose this moment to ask this question. Now, as fans, and this is something Rob said on Twitter, we're not here to be cheerleaders. We're not, as journalists, sorry, we're not here to be cheerleaders. We're here to ask questions. If you want everyone to just go in and celebrate the title with Pep Guardiola and say, oh, you're brilliant, Pep. Fine, we'll do that. And we'll get rid of all the newspapers, all the news websites, the BBC, every single outlet. And we'll just sit here and we'll just enjoy Manchester City. And that's fine. You can enjoy Manchester City all you want. But there are two sides to it. You can only enjoy it if you also do the hard yards. If you ask the difficult questions and do the difficult things. And I feel a bit for Pep Guardiola, really, because in some ways, he's been hung out to dry here. You know, it's not as though anyone else from Manchester City ever goes in front of the media and answers that question. And, you know, you can hear the press officer there, and it is his job to try and shield the club from these stories. But there are a lot of these stories starting to build up. Manchester City have just been referred to the UEFA's disciplinary commission over alleged breaches of financial fair play. Now, that's an important story. Not because I agree with financial fair play. I think it's a bit of a sham, frankly. But it's an important story because it shows Man City trying to subvert the workings of football, if indeed they're found to have breached those regulations. So that's why this is important. That's why it's important for journalists to keep chasing this. Because if you are, as a football fan, and this is what I hear from football fans all the time, is, oh, the game's gone, our game's being ruined. If you are one of those fans, you need to know that it's not just UEFA who are necessarily making mistakes here. It's not just money pouring into the game. There are machinations of power going on here. But you don't need me to tell you. You need Rob Harris to tell you. And I'm glad to say we've got him on the line now. Rob, this is probably going to be one of the easier interviews you've had to do over the last couple of days, because I think we might just be in agreement over a few things. First of all...
Always fine being challenged.
Yes, very good. That question you asked Pep Guardiola, maybe for people who don't know the story quite as well, you could explain the context of it.
Yeah, I mean, there were two questions. The first was actually more of a broader question, which was the fact that we could not ignore the fact this final had taken place against the backdrop of the escalation of the UEFA financial fair play case. So, you know, to not ask about one of the big issues, not only of the week, but in world football, would seem amiss. So actually, you know, I first of all started by congratulating Pep on the, you know, the footballing achievement on the pitch, you know, getting the treble, and also a recognition of the fact that Guardiola himself is not on the board, he's not responsible for the finances, but then asking how he, you know, responds to those who say in some way that, you know, the achievements are diminished because of the investigations, of which he gave a response which said he, you know, trusted the club, something we've become used to hearing from him. At that point, you know, I thought, well, actually, maybe it's the chance, because the final press conference of the season, to raise the unanswered question I put to City in November, since Guardiola was so determined to protest the club's innocence, which is the fact that last November the Football League showed that Roberto Mancini, our City manager, earned a salary that, you know, was allegedly higher than his City salary from one of from Sheikh Mansour, the owner's club in Abu Dhabi. You know, we've not heard any more response on that. We've not heard anything about that. You know, on one face of it, it would mean, you know, it could be about City's compliance with financial fair play in terms of keeping down losses, which keeping down the wage bill. We don't know anything about that. It's not a, you know, it's a sporting matter that would come under as well in terms of regulations. We've not heard more on that. But so it's just asking Guardiola whether he also received any money from Abu Dhabi, which is a perfectly legitimate thing to do if declared in the right way, etc., from advising any clubs and, you know, within the you know, necessary structures. And rather than just sort of saying a yes or no, he was obviously quite indignant and quite angry to be asked about that, which, you know, many people debate the timing and was it right to ask him.
Do you think he's angry with you, or do you think he was angry with, well, and I'll let you choose from these options, A, the perceived thing that the media are biased against Manchester City, or actually that he's been a little bit hung out to dry by his employers here because he has to go and face the media every week and they don't?
Yeah, I mean, it's a difficult situation to say on many fronts. The fact that we will ask the person who is the face of the club about the investigation. Should City be putting someone up who actually is more responsible and accountable for those matters? Well, I did set out a question as he walked through the mix zone to Cal Brunel Barrett, the chairman. Didn't respond, just smiled and thumbs up when asked about the Champions League ban. So, you know, he's not willing to speak. You've got Ferran Soriano, the chief executive, when he was doorstepped outside a Premier League meeting by the BBC in November. He wouldn't engage on the matter. So the only person that can who can be asked about this is the manager, who isn't on the board of directors. And, you know, it's a point I've made in recent months, including on Twitter, the fact that actually, you know, there's an element that is unfair on Guardiola. He has to be the person who has to discuss about matters that he's not knowledgeable of firsthand in terms of the specifics of how City did or did not try to circumvent financial fair play rules to ensure their compliance. So it's, you know, you can see why he is increasingly irritated by that. But then the obligation is on his club, or you put up, or the spokesperson who is next to him is the one who fields the question. I mean, you see this quite often at Chelsea where the manager will push the questions and it will be him as the face appearing on camera discussing matters like that. So, you can see why he was irritated, but City did have the chance to prove this people off when I asked them at times in November last year. And, you know, there is a communication spreading on their side to think this would just fade away, particularly back in the spotlight, financial fair play, because of the case escalating this week.
Do you think they will ever, I mean, look, I don't know whether you're going to get given the exclusive at this point, who knows, but you can only ask and you shall receive. Do you think they will ever put someone up to address this kind of issue, to come out and say, look, this isn't Pep Guardiola, this is us, and we'll talk about it?
And on the broader front, you can understand why City don't want to necessarily put an accountable executive up in front of the cameras at the moment, because their bigger priority is what they would see as winning the UEFA case, not being banned from the Champions League.
Right.
So this could go to appeal. So anything you do say in public could then form part of the case itself, if there's, you know, one comment here, one comment there. So, you know, arguably it's not a media battle they have to win, but the one with UEFA behind the scenes. It could reach the Court of Arbitration for Sport ultimately, and, you know, if they are banned, I mean, obviously it would be after that point when you'd expect or hope they were asked about it. And then City do things in a very controlled way to that degree, in terms of who they put up, who discuss the club, and who they put up to explain things. I mean, there's obviously many questions beyond financial fair play about just how it fits into the Abu Dhabi structures and the objectives to the other team, where the owner's been, by all accounts, once in 10 in 11 years.
Rob, I should also ask you, because you seem to have, news just followed you this weekend, it would seem. You were in the press box at the FA Cup final when this City fan, well, came and told you what he thought of all of you, essentially. Do you think that sort of plays into what City fans think of the media generally? Do you think he's an outlier? I didn't really know what to make of it, frankly.
Yeah, it wasn't addressing me directly. It was actually probably about five seats away from me. He was at the edge of the press box. He'd come in from behind, from a central position, and was just addressing the remnants of the press box post-match more broadly. I mean, what it seemed to me is it was basically Twitter in human form. You know, the sort of that tribal passion that goes too far in terms of this perception that the media is against City somehow, because of, you know, comparing coverage and believing Salah gets more coverage at times than City, and the fact this perception really perpetuated by Guardiola at times, and that City, Liverpool are the media darlings, no one wants City to win, which is fueling an anti-media agenda, which you know, we do see in parts of political life these days as well. Rather than the fact that actually, you know, doesn't affect us who wins the title. We just, you know, we'll think which is the more interesting story, you know, along various ways. So it's not like we have any influence on it in any way.
Yes, turns out football fans and journalists are two different things, but some people don't seem to understand that. Fame, Rob, thank you very much for coming on. I'm sure that was a slightly less confrontational than a lot of conversations Rob's had this weekend. It's Rob Harris there. He's the AP Global Football Sports writer and a guy who's asking the difficult questions, which is your job as a journalist. You're there to ask the difficult questions, even if there aren't any answers.
Love Sport.
Now, England selectors will name their World Cup squad tomorrow morning, and someone is going to miss out. Joffre Archer's emergence means that someone will not get the chance to play in a home World Cup this summer. They're all nervously waiting that phone call, I'm sure, today and tomorrow. Let's speak to someone who I don't think has been on the receiving end of that particular phone call too often. It's former England international Alan Lamb, who joins us now. Alan, it must be a nervous wait, no matter how certain you are of being in the squad, is it?
Well, it's a tough one, because, you know, they've all been performing. With the Joffre coming in, they're definitely going to play him, it looks like, you know, with his pace and that. We haven't seen too much of him with a bat, but he looks quite useful with the ball. Yes, it's going to be a nervous wait for the bowlers. I think, you know, Wokes is going to definitely play. He'll be in there as a cert. Then basically they've got to make a choice on, you know, you've got Woods, Plunkett, say Archer's in. Mm. So that's three certainty. Then you've got Woods, Plunkett, Willie and Curran. So, you know, it's going to be tight.
I know that you have a special connection with one of those bowlers a little bit more than others, Tom Curran, and of course the whole Curran family you know very, very well. From a personal perspective, for people who maybe don't know, can you tell us a little bit about your relationship with the Curran family?
Basically, I sort of have helped the Curran boys. They lost their father, and basically, you know, I helped them get over here. Basically, Tom, you know, his dad was more the instigator of him probably going to Surrey than my involvement, really. So he was sort of taken care of. But then I looked after the other two brothers, Ben and Sam, because they were still based in Zimbabwe.
Yeah.
So Tom was already over here at Stowe, I mean at Wellington School.
Yes.
And then, you know, I got the two other brothers to come over.
Yeah, as if your influence on English cricket wasn't enough with 200 appearances and more. Bringing over the Curran family, of course, is a great boon. Tell me about Tom's development as a cricketer, because, you know, we've seen him really flourish into this multi-talented guy, and we don't know whether he's going to miss out tomorrow morning, but either way, how impressed have you been by the cricketer that he now is?
Well, he's come on leaps and bounds. I mean, he's just got better and better. And the big thing, he likes to be in the thick of things. So, you know, if it's got to score runs, he's got so much better. He could always bat. I mean, he was always a good batter. And I've been telling him, you know, he's got to concentrate more on his batting because he can bat. And then, you know, he's bowling. The thing is, it's going to be very difficult to leave him out because I think, you know, he bowled brilliantly at the death, and he mixes it up so much where a lot of the other bowlers don't. And, you know, without being biased, I think you probably listen to the commentators too. They all feel that he should be picked because he offers a little bit difference with all those slower balls and everything. He offers a little bit different to the other bowlers. So, you know, but I, you know, he's learning all the time and he's getting better and better. So I would definitely put him in that England World Cup squad.
And you've obviously played in World Cups before. How important is having that balance and that variety within the squad? It is about creating a group, not just picking the best 15 players.
Yeah, it does. You know, that's one of the big factor. But, you know, you want to have your best side out and the best squad. And they got loads of batters, as we've seen. I mean, they bat all the way down. So,
yeah.
With, you know, they've had Denley, you know, do they keep him? Because the other, you know, you've got Jofra who can bat, you've got Curran who can bat. You got Rashid who can bat. So either they stick with the bowlers and leave Denley out.
Yeah. The World Cup itself, I saw a few comments yesterday about this Pakistan series that England have played. And great they've won it 4-0, but, you know, we've seen a lot of 380 plays 350, 370 plays 340. Do you think it would be a shame if we went into this summer's World Cup and we saw lots of flat pitches, lots of small grounds and lots of 700-plus run games?
Well, listen, that's what one-day cricket's become to really now. They want the flattest wickets, and the crowds come in to, you know, see the ball banged all over the place. I mean, it's like the 2020, you know. But I think the wickets are going to, if we have a good summer like this, then, you know, most of the grounds, they're going to be flat wickets. So they're going to be big scores. And it's the bowlers that perform on the day. And you know, if they can hold their nerve. But the big thing about the competition is that it's the same competition as the same format as we played in 92, where everyone plays each other once. So instead of being in groups, you know, you have to win your group stage to go through, or the first two in that group go. Everyone has to play against everyone. So it's going to be the most consistent sides that make it through to the semi-final. I mean, if you have a look at Pakistan in 92, they lost two games, had one rained off, and then went and qualified by beating New Zealand in the semi-final and ended up playing in the final. So no one's really out of it, you know. So, but I think it's going to be the side that performs the most consistently.
And we have to talk about England as favourites now. They've sort of been billed as that for a while, but I think their performances over the last couple of months have reinforced that tag. I can't remember us ever being real favourites, you know, clear favourites for a World Cup. I wonder if that might help a little bit, help England do what they've always failed to do, which I think is carry themselves with a little bit of arrogance.
Yeah, I mean, listen, we were in 92, we were sort of up there as the favourites. Mm. And we played like the favourites. I mean, we were a good side, but I think we just ran out of steam a little bit at the end. Now, as long as England keep, you know, producing the goods and keep performing, they will be up there. And, you know, but it's who performs on the day is the big thing. You know, it's fine. You've got 8 games to play, or 6 games, whatever it is. You have to perform every day, and you can't sort of take your foot off the pedal. But I just think that, you know, there's some very good. India, you know, maybe second favourites, definitely second favourites. I'd have them as the 2 favourites. Then you got Australia and New Zealand, which anything can happen. They've got good teams. West Indies turned over us on different wickets. So, but you've got to remember, then you've got Pakistan. Pakistan, if they can get their bowling right and their fielding right, can be a serious threat because they've got some incredible good batters.
Mm.
And then, you know, South Africa, I just don't think they have the batsmen. They've got the bowlers, but they haven't got the batsmen. And missing, you know, quite a lot of players are playing in the English competition, yeah. If those guys were playing for South Africa, South Africa would be a force, but I can't see them being a force.
Yeah, it's a bit of a shame, really, but that's a whole kettle of fish that we probably don't have time to open right now, Alan. That's former England international Alan Lamb there, of course. England will name their squad for the Cricket World Cup tomorrow morning. Will it include Tom Curran? He desperately hopes so.
Love sport.
Let's speak to a man who I'm sure will not be looking forward to a post-Vincent Kompany City era, even if it is a trophy-laden one. For Manchester City and Brighton forward Gordon Smith is on the line now. Gordon, I was just saying how big a loss Vincent Kompany will be for City. Do you think it'll be harder to replace him as a player or as a captain?
I think both, actually, you know, because I think you're looking at when you have a football team, you're always looking for people who are leaders. And that's a key aspect. I mean, sometimes they say the best teams have quite a few leaders in the team, not just one. And I think that he falls into that category, not only a top-class player, but somebody who, you know, the players will respect, someone who gives a level of performance all the time that you know, of a top-class team and a top-class player. So from that point of view, then, I think he'll be a loss. But he has had a marvellous career at City, and you know, he's got to an age now where maybe it's time for him to move on, and City just have to look round and try and find someone who falls into the category of replacing him. You know, they need to get the recruitment people will be already have been out looking for a similar type of player.
When you have people like that in the dressing room and they leave, does it sometimes leave a bit of a vacuum? You know, I wonder if you've had it where you lose a player like that, and then first day of pre-season next year, everyone's looking around going, oh, who's going to do the speech? Who's going to be the guy to get us up when we're down?
Yeah, no, there's no question on that. I mean, that was one of my first season at Rangers. The captain of the team was John Gregg.
Hmm.
And John Gregg was a leader. He'd been in the team for 20 years at that point. And then, but then what happened was John Gregg became the manager then. So you lost him from the point of view of that element on the field, that leadership on the park, and that was a bit of a blow to lose somebody of that kind of quality. So it does have an effect. There's no doubt about it that, you know, you do need a... Brighton was the same. When I went to Brighton, Brian Horton was a captain, and he was a similar type. Brian Horton was a leader, you know, and he was a general there and played in the midfield, and he spoke to everyone in the dressing room. He was a character as well. So there's no question about it. You do need... But we're looking around, and we're looking for somebody else who's already at the club to be like that, and there's no doubt about it, they'll be looking closely at recruitment element to see who that kind of character is elsewhere, someone who can come in and have that sort of level of respect from everyone.
You mentioned Brighton there. We understand they've got a press conference this afternoon at 4:30, and we understand that will likely be to name Graham Potter as their new manager. First of all, were you quite sad to see Chris Hughton go?
I was, actually. I felt that, you know, it was a shame that I thought he'd done really well, and I don't know why. Maybe it was they had a bad little run there just before the end of the season. But, you know, they managed to stay up, so it's one of these things that, you know, you must think that the you know, the board have got some sort of ideas about who they're going to bring in. The lad Potter, I don't know much about him, but I'm not sure whether he qualifies in the with the same sort of level of performance and respect that Chris Hughton would have, because he's you know, he's managing at the moment at Swansea, isn't he?
Exactly, and you know, it's an unusual path into it. And I think when we speak to football people, everyone talks about Chris Hughton in very warm terms, and I think everyone is a little bit confused, especially when you look, because for me, if you look at the Brighton squad, the recruitment's not been great. Surely he's not been given the support from upstairs, and they haven't brought the players in for him to deal with.
Well, that's what you need to ask about, whether, you know, that would be the question that he would need to answer, whether he actually got that level of support. I mean, I know for a fact that, you know, they're very keen to stay in the Premier Division, and I know that the directors there, especially the chairman, Tony Bloom, wants to, you know, have his team there. And I think maybe what you're finding is maybe the fact is that they've just managed to stay up is out with what their goal is. Maybe they want to be up challenging a bit more. They maybe want to be, you know, definitely a top half of this at the table rather than be just avoiding relegation. So maybe they feel that they need to get somebody in that changes that about. So that the time will tell. I mean, the main thing about it is that when every managerial appointment is a risk. There's no matter who it is that comes in, even if he's had a great reputation from before or whether he hasn't, it's always a risk element to see whether that manager can deal with that group of players and get the best out of it. He might have an idea himself. I don't know who does the recruitment at Brighton, whether it's you know, the chairman's involved in it, whether the director of football or whether the manager has a strong say in it. But that will be the test now to see whether, having got rid of Chris Hughton now, they have to be very clear that the new manager has to come in and take the club to another level.
Just very, very quickly, Gordon, because it'd be remiss of me not to ask you, Steve Clarke being limped with the Scotland job over the last couple of days, would you like to see him given that opportunity?
Yeah, I think he's definitely getting it. You know, I was at a function last night and he was made manager of the year for the second year in a row. And what he said, his final piece of his speech, he said, it's great to get this award twice. And he says, if I get this award again next year, then everyone will be really happy. Now, I think that's a giveaway. What do you think?
Yeah, it's a very cryptic indeed. Gordon, thank you so much for coming on. Always a pleasure to speak to you. Gordon Smith there, former Man City and Brighton forward, and also former chief exec of the Scottish Football Association as well. And he reckons Steve Clarke is definitely getting the Scotland job. Well, I mean, stranger things have happened in football, but I don't think there'll be many men who deserve it more than Steve Clarke.
Love Sport.
Brooks Koepka there, four consecutive bogeys on the back nine, having said that there's absolutely no doubt in his mind that he would be winning the tournament. So it's the kind of thing you can only say that if you're absolutely certain you're going to go on. But from seven shots ahead, it would have been an almighty choke if actually he had not won the tournament. So credit to Brooks Koepka, did the job and didn't actually manage to mess it up too badly. But I wonder, you know, if I were playing with Brooks, let's say last round of the Open at Portrush, and he's four or five shots clear and he starts dropping shots, wouldn't you just, if you were in competition with him, wouldn't you just go, oh, hello, Brooks. It's familiar, isn't it? Done this before. You wouldn't want to get three bogeys, you know, it might turn into four. You'd definitely have a word, wouldn't you? You definitely would. Maybe you're not allowed to sledge in golf, but you are allowed to sledge in cricket, and there'll be plenty of that this summer, because England are playing in the World Cup, of course, a home World Cup, followed by an Ashes series. And this afternoon, the England selectors will meet, decide on the 15 men who will represent them in a home World Cup this summer. The majority of the names on that team sheet we already know. They'll have been penned in, traced over, pencilled, underlined, highlighted, and practically enshrined in law. You know, there are probably 11 or 12 names on that list that, well, we're more certain about than what will happen with Brexit. I know that's a low bar, but there are about 12 guys who are definitely going to play. But there are still probably only one, but maybe two, maybe as many as two spots up for grabs. But that's a positive thing, isn't it? I think that's just about the right balance. You want the strength in depth because it creates competition for places. It creates a bit of drive, a bit of jeopardy for those who may be underperforming. It improves everyone as a group. And that's what Owen Morgan was saying in that interview that we heard a little bit earlier, that actually everyone is improving. And that makes it very, very hard to leave anyone out because no one deserves not to be there. You know, Michael Vaughan was saying that it's going to be the worst conversation an England captain or selector has had because whoever misses out deserves to be in that team. is absolutely right. And he went on to say, I don't know how many times I've said in my life, I think Michael Vaughan's got it right, but it's a handful. Going back a few World Cups, we struggled to finalise an 11. Now we have a group of about 20 players who can all make that 11. And that's absolutely right. It's why England is so strong. It's not just the brand of cricket. Not just the fact that they can go out and score 400 on a regular basis. Not just their death bowling and excellent fielding as we saw yesterday. It's really that they have so many different players who can do it in different combinations. How many times have we sat around and gone, oh, who should open the England for batting? This person, this person, this person. It's actually... I think it's more important that England have an overall group than they have a settled 11. You can make changes to the team every week if you want to. And I think, actually, that's how they should be approaching it. The World Cup is a long, long tournament. It's 7 weeks? 6 weeks? In that time, you're going to get injuries, especially with the number of games they're playing. And so, within that squad, they need to actually be able to make two changes every game and feel that their team is not weaker. They need to adapt to conditions and feel that their team is not weaker. You saw it in the last home World Cup, we reached a final and lost. We reached a semi-final and lost there. What happened in the final? The West Indies got done by a nibbling seamer. And so you have to be able to pick the right team for that right day and the right wicket. Now, the men who are probably going to miss out is one of, we think, David Willey, Tom Curran and Liam Plunkett. Now, I'm not sure which of those will. I know in my mind, I think David Willey should be the one to miss out. He is in that team because England have always thought that they needed a left-armer. They've always liked the idea of having a left-arm seamer in the attack. Right back to the days of Alan Mullally. They've always liked having that alternative option. And I do think having a balanced attack is important. You know, we spoke to Alan Lamont. I think you'll get the chance to hear that interview again a little bit later on. And he was saying how important it is to have different types of bowler in the attack. And I do appreciate that David Willey, by being left-handed, is different. He also swings the ball. And that's important because as a left-arm seamer, you swing the ball back into the right-handed batsman and that makes a difference. But I don't think he's quick enough. I don't think he's performed well enough. You know, when the pressure's been on, and let's face it, in the last couple of one-dayers, because England have stopped picking Jofra Archer, that tells you that they know he's going. So all these fast bowlers have been told, pretty much, even if not in as many words, then by the actions taken against them, they've all pretty much been told, your place is up for grabs, you need to put in a performance today. David Willey hasn't done that. Tom Curran has shown that he can do that. And Tom Curran, I think, has shown he's a more dynamic cricketer. You know, his 29 off 15 balls up at Headingley yesterday pretty much won England the game because it gave them some impetus, gave them some momentum. It obviously grabbed them 30 extra runs, which is crucial as well. But it gave England the feeling that, we've gone from making a sort of average total to making an excellent total. And that puts more pressure on the chasing team. So that was absolutely crucial. And I think you can't underestimate that multi-talented cricketer. David Willey, he's opened the batting in T20 cricket for Yorkshire. We've seen that a bit. But he doesn't have that kind of record of doing it at the international level. So I think that what has happened over the last 12 months is Tom Curran has just swum past David Willey. Curran also gives us a massive amount of ability at the death. You know, he bowls a great variety at the death. His Yorkers. And I'm not saying Willey can't do that because we have seen him do it on occasion as well. But I think Curran just gives you a little bit more. And at the end of the day, it feels harsh on David Willey. It really does. But he doesn't swing the ball as much as he used to. He hasn't performed as well as he used to. And when you've got a deep squad and you've got young cricketers coming through, you don't get the chance to decay in the team. As soon as you fall out of form, there is someone to take your place. And sadly, I think that's the harsh reality David Willey might have to come to terms with this afternoon.
Love Sport.
There wasn't many bigger than Gareth Bale's performance at Real Madrid. Now, when I say performance, mostly his absence. Because after the last game of the season, as we all know, it's traditional for the players to go out on the pitch, applaud the fans, wave to their friends, maybe take their children out, let a cute four-year-old score a goal at the Bernabeu, you know, the usual sort of thing. None of that for Gareth Bale, though. Having been substituted, he went straight down the tunnel. He went straight down the tunnel. He went, we should turn it into a song. Well, you know what? I'll get Bell and Sperling to write that, because that's funny. Gareth Bale went straight down the tunnel. I think it'll be brilliant. Anyway, the point was that Bale had been substituted and wasn't best pleased about it. He's had a tumultuous time at Real Madrid, especially of late, and it's starting to look a lot like he is going to leave the club. A lot of pressure was on him to replace Cristiano Ronaldo, naturally, because when a player like that leaves, it leaves a massive vacuum, a huge hole for him to fill. Now, Gareth Bale has had good times at Real Madrid. 2 goals in the Champions League final against Liverpool, for example, although Loris Karius can probably take some credit for those. But this season has not been one of them. It's not been a good year for him, and it's starting to look like things have gone sour. But for me, things have never been sweet. You can say they've gone sour, but I'm not convinced that it's ever been perfect. Because when he first went over in 2013, I remember him doing an interview with Steve McManaman in South Wales. And they were just chatty. Of course, Maka, one of the great players to go over to Spain, one of the very few English players to go over and make it work in Spain, did brilliantly with Real Madrid. And they chatted through different things and, you know, talked about learning Spanish and getting used to the culture. And a couple of years later, one or two, when Bale was starting to first look like he wasn't totally adapting to life in Madrid, I interviewed Steve McManaman. And I asked him about making life work in Spain. And he said, I'll give you why it worked for me. And he said he went out for dinner. He'd been there 6 months and he was trying to talk to a waiter. And he was pointing to something on the menu and he was saying in that extremely strong Scouser, is this doch? Is this doch? And he couldn't make himself understood to the extent that he was stood up in a restaurant, flapping his arms like wings, going, is this doch? Is this doch? And his missus said, I think you probably should learn, learn Spanish, Steve. I think it's about time. And at that point, he realised he absolutely had to. Now, when Gareth Bale goes out, and again, Maka admitted this, when he goes out with his entourage, you know, with his group of mates and his agent and his head of social media and his head of security, he doesn't need to speak Spanish, but he should. And he should have gone out of his way to make sure that his Spanish was excellent. It's hard learning a foreign language, but he's been there for 6 years. He's been living in Spain for 6 years. Not only does it make you feel more settled, and that's important, to feel like you fit in. If you want to perform properly, you need to feel like you can fit in. Not only that, but it shows to your teammates that you're committed to the project, that you're trying to be part of Real Madrid. And that has been a problem too. They call him the golfer because it's what he spends most of his time doing. He doesn't go on team nights out because he doesn't like eating late at night. So he doesn't go to those team dinners. Those things make your teammates think you don't want to be there. And that's very difficult for them to handle. And if they then think that they can't handle you, you start to get that back off them and you feel uncomfortable. And if you're uncomfortable, you're unhappy. And if you're unhappy, you're not going to be any good at football. So the problem is that Bale set himself up to fail. He had to throw himself into life in Madrid and it doesn't sound like he has. There have been other factors too, you know, struggles with injuries, but it doesn't excuse the fact that it doesn't feel like he's made an effort to really make it home. Now, the fans haven't helped either, and you have to question the Real Madrid fans who booed Cristiano Ronaldo at the end, who whistled Cristiano Ronaldo, and are now booing and whistling Gareth Bale. You have to question them too. But the bigger question now comes, where does Gareth Bale go? What does he do? Because at the time of his career, he's got one big contract left in him. He's 29. He'll turn 30 this summer. And that is a point at which a guy like him needs to say, what am I going to do? Where am I going to end my career? Because he's had 7 years at Tottenham. He's had 6-7 years at Real Madrid. And now it looks like that's not working out. Zinedine Zidane doesn't appear to be a fan. So what does he do? We know that Manchester United have been keen on Bale for some time. And you can understand why. He's obviously one of the best British players in the world. There's a strong connection between Wales and Manchester United, if not South Wales. He ticks a lot of boxes for Ed Woodward in terms of a marquee signing. You know, I mean, Real Madrid know all about marquee signings. It's their raison d'etre. But he would tick a lot of boxes there. For me, the problem is, if they want Ole Gunnar Solskjaer to play fast-flowing football, I don't know what Bale can add to that. Sure, 5 years ago, maybe. But if he wants to play fast counter-attacking football, Bale's game is going to start to evolve as he gets older. Like Ronaldo's did, like Rooney's did, like Beckham's did when he went over to Spain. So they need to really understand how Bale's body is going to change and how his playing style is going to adapt. Because United cannot afford to make another signing that doesn't fit their style. They've done it so many times. Fred, Matic, Romelu Lukaku, Zlatan Ibrahimovic. They need to make signings now that fit into their style, that fit into their plan, whatever that plan might be. Would he come back to Tottenham? He would love to, I think. More than 200 appearances there. It's where he made his name. Obviously, they've got that stunning new stadium. They're in the Champions League next year. You can see why it would be attractive. But is that realistic? Spurs aren't going to buy him. I just don't see that happening. They're not going to pay him £370,000 a week. And his agent says that he's happy to play golf for 3 years at Real Madrid and make that money. He wants someone to match it. Might Chelsea sign him? I don't think it's beyond the realms of possibility. They're likely to have this transfer ban commuted because that's what Spanish clubs previously have been afforded. And it means that they could look at taking Gareth Bale this summer. Even if it's only for a year, pay what, £15 million, £20 million to loan him for a year and just fill a gap, potentially one left by Eden Hazard. Maybe even they say, look, we'll only talk about Hazard to Madrid if you talk about Bale coming the other way. Maybe it's the perfect move for them to put a sticking plaster over what's going to be a messy summer. Whatever the case, I do want to see Gareth Bale not at Real Madrid next season. Because it hasn't worked now. He hasn't adapted to it. He's not going to change now. And he was a fabulous footballer. And he can still be a fabulous footballer. Maybe it's time for him to come home.
This is Love Sport.
You've been listening to the James Gray Show podcast edition. Please do leave us a rating and a review wherever you get your podcasts. And remember, you can listen to the show live on Love Sport Radio every weekday from 1 p.m. until 3:30.